Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects we all struggle with in this conversation with a reluctant therapist. Happy Tuesday, Elizabeth.
Happy Tuesday, Hank.
Where is our journey taking us today?
Well, it's interesting that you ask because there's a lot of different roads to today's topic. The first one is kind of this idea of these circular conversations that my dad is famous for having. You know, you'll say, "Hey, Dad, how are things going?" It's like, "Oh, I don't know. You know, things have been kind of a struggle. Things aren't always as easy as they should be." And I go, "That's a bummer, Dad. Sorry, things are hard." He goes, "Well, life is supposed to be hard. You never get too bogged down." It's like, that's great. What a super attitude that is to have. "Well, you know, I mean, you never know when things are going to be terrible." It's like my dad is an expert at taking conversations and being able to tell the story from the good and bad perspective over and over. And so if you join him on one train of thought, he'll usually dart and go the other way, you know, and he might present one of the stories as being dark and gloomy. And as soon as you get to the dark and gloom, he bounces.
Well, it could be worse.
Yes, it could be worse. So I was thinking about the circular conversations I have with my dad. And then I was thinking about how sometimes, even in our best intentions, right, we're trying hard to help someone out, or we think we're doing something of great service to others or to a country or for a community, and those well-intended events tend to end up being more harmful than helpful. And how can we kind of look at our good intentions as not maybe always being good intentions, or in the best interest of those who want to help? So there's that. And then I was thinking about that even on the worst days of our life, even in times when we really feel like things are horrible, and we talked about this a couple of weeks ago, the idea of, you know, always being in the process of coming together or falling apart, even when we're in the process of falling apart, there's good things that are happening. You know, nothing ever happens alone. You can be struggling with cancer, and yet you can be celebrating the birth of a grandchild or go on a dream vacation. It's like we don't get to compartmentalize life's events, that the good and the bad all happen at the same time. And also this idea that we tend to rage against the injustices of life. You know, when someone gets ill or they die, we rage against this. This should never happen. They're good people. It should never have, you know, been part of their journey. And yet it is part of everyone's journey, that we all will get sick. We all will die. We'll suffer with tragedies. And we spend so much time raging against those normal life injustices. I think it prevents us from being able to actually find peace with and cope with those things that are inevitable. So overall, I keep thinking about how we can be more prepared to deal with whatever comes our way, to kind of accept that nothing is all bad or all good, that it's all just stuff. And while I was thinking about all of these stories, I came across a Shakespeare quote, which I'm sure excites you. I just saw your eyes gloss over.
Exactly. That. I mean, I was with you the whole time there until the word Shakespeare comes across, and then my brain kind of goes blank.
All right, well, just
whatever's going to come out of Elizabeth's mouth next is not going to register.
But it will stay with me, though, because a famous line from Hamlet was, "There is nothing either good or bad, but thinking makes it so." You follow me with that one?
I kind of get that. I understand more what you were saying before that about how even in tragedy there is some good and bad, and it's the whole enchilada in there.
Yeah, it is the whole package. And I think the key to this idea, there is nothing either good or bad, but thinking makes it so, it's that everything in life is a perception of how we want to identify what's happening in the moment. Where are we going to say this is good or this is bad? And how we perceive it then impacts the way we behave. It starts the chain in motion. It starts life happening in one direction. All of a sudden we're on this road, and then one thing leads to another, and we find ourselves, I don't know, moving in the direction of truth as it becomes.
The deception with tight. Just what are you trying to say? You got a blank face, but you're a dance. Communicate, pull out your body piece. You see dimensions into one. State your case with black or white. But when one little glass leads to shots, scripture.
This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and thank you for joining us this afternoon. And I chose that song to kind of lead us into the show, but also because it's in Hank's wheelhouse. And every week we talk about the music we're going to use in the show. And so I try to bring in music that's going to get Hank motivated and excited to stay with the topic. That's The Fix. One thing leads to another. And today we're going to talk about this idea of things being all good or all bad, and that things aren't ever all good or all bad, that there is a bit of both in everything, just as there is a bit of both in all of us, that we're all capable of things that are good and bad at any given time in our life, and how we either accept those different dichotomous parts of our lives or reject them can really impact our mental health and well-being. That's one piece of it. But I also want to talk about how in our culture, we tend to vilify certain behaviors or certain ways of being or certain thoughts as being all bad, and that they need to be eradicated from the human experience. And in our attempt to eradicate bad behaviors from the human experience, we unintentionally, in some ways, make those behaviors more insidious. They become more entrenched, more difficult to deal with, because instead of eradicating bad behaviors, we just send it deeper. And I'm not trying to be mysterious, but I kind of want to lead into the topic in such a way that hopefully you'll stay with my train of thought, because it's definitely a train of thought of one thing leads to another that got me to today's topic. So I hope you'll be patient and bear with me. But for example, when you think of your children's behavior, when we try to extinguish a child's behavior that we don't like by punishing them or shaming them or, you know, just attacking them in some way that makes them feel afraid or frightened, it doesn't make the behavior go away. It may stop it in that moment, but it doesn't make it go away. It just tells the child, I need to get more sneaky about my behaviors so that my parents don't bust me or my teacher doesn't bust me. You know, just calling a child out or punishing them or taking something away does not teach them the lessons about why their behavior is unacceptable and motivate them to change that behavior so that their life is more fulfilling or better. When we just use punishment as a tool, we just encourage people to get sneakier with the unacceptable behavior. And so this idea that nothing is all bad or all good comes up in every part of our life. And so while I was thinking about not just the behavior of children or how we talk about our life situation, you know, you can be having the best day ever, but there's still things that bother us. So I was kind of fiddling around looking for good examples or examples I thought would be helpful for this topic. And of course, I came upon a clip from Family Feud. And yes, I'm talking about that Family Feud, because nothing is more fun than the odd and awkward clips of things that people say on the Family Feud. Maybe it's just me. But I do think that some of the funniest things ever have been said in quick response to the Family Feud. And this is a clip from a show that directly addressed when something is all bad or all good. Even when something is bad, it can still be considered good. And so let's listen to the clip. And there's two parts to it. One is very obvious answer to something is bad and can still be good. It's the second response that I find hysterical. And we'll talk a little bit more about that when we come back. So let's hear the Family Feud.
Hi, Big G.
Gentlemen, top seven answers on the board. Name something that even when it's bad, it's good.
Sex.
What'd I tell you? All his answers is rock and roll answers. Y'all thought I was lying to you? Okay. Sex! DJ.
Milk, Steve.
Huh?
Milk. You gotta put it in mashed potatoes. You can't throw that milk away, Steve. Well, you're right. You go. Yeah.
Bad milk?
Bad milk, Steve. I'm from L.A., Birmingham, Alabama.
Hey, I was about poor as they come. Mama didn't use bad milk.
What's she use, water?
No, it's called buttermilk. Oh. Milk! Yeah.
And so, ironically, sex was the number two most answered response, and the number one most answered response to the question, something, even when it's bad, can still be good. The response answer was food or dessert. Even when it's a terrible dessert, it's better than a lousy form of some other food. I just thought that was hysterical, and I love that the question was asked, because it is that reminder that even those things that we think are amazing in the moment might to other people not look like such a great idea or great experience. So we're going to open up the phone lines today, and we're going to talk about this idea of things being all good or all bad, and the split that we have as a culture in trying to vilify certain behaviors and eradicate them and try to promote better behaviors. So we'll open up the phone lines in a little bit. The number is 805-781-3875. You can also be part of our conversation on our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist. You can send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com if you'd like to connect that way. You can also listen to previous shows at kcbx.org under the News Talk tab, or subscribe to our podcast through Apple Tunes. And I looked through the NPR One app also, which is new. And if you go to the NPR One app and your home station, I think, I don't know if it doesn't matter what your home station is, but you type in a conversation with a reluctant therapist, all of the podcasts come up that way also. So there's a lot of ways to keep up with the show, but we always like to hear from you and hear what's kind of resonating with you on these topics. So I've been elusive enough about what I'm talking about as far as those vilified behaviors. And let's start off with the idea of drug and alcohol abuse. Now, we would probably all agree that drug and alcohol abuse is a huge concern for our culture. We are in an opiate epidemic as we speak. Alcoholism is one of the number one causes of death in middle-aged men. Suicide can be a result of alcohol and drug abuse. You know, it is something that we as parents have tried to address with our children for years, to teach them to stay away from drugs, just say no, don't imbibe. And the program that was developed in the 80s to address drug and alcohol abuse was the DARE program. And I'm assuming that you were part of the DARE program, Bree, at some point in your life?
I know of it, but I was actually, I never really was in it. I went to a really small Catholic school when I was young, and about that age where young kids are typically taught things like that.
But they didn't have the formal program.
Yeah. I mean, we were taught, drugs and alcohol are bad, and it was more in the context of God thinks they are bad, because it's a Catholic school. So,
right. So you didn't have the formal mandated program. So this DARE program was lauded as, the way to get to our young people and to shut down the drug and alcohol epidemics in our culture, that we would eradicate drug and alcohol abuse if we could just get to the children and teach them about DARE and bring in, police officers and really get them to understand the dangers. And yet DARE turned out to be a horribly failed program. And unfortunately, it's a program that is being revisited by our government today, by, Jeff Sessions and his group, I think, would like to bring back DARE. But it was a failed program. It didn't reduce drug and alcohol abuse. In some cases, research showed that it increased drug and alcohol abuse in children, that the wearing the DARE T-shirt started to become kind of a ha-ha at parties. And the reason it was a failed program was that it was not giving students the tools to address the realities of society. It was setting them up for a story that wasn't true. Because you can tell children it's bad for you, don't drink, don't do drugs, you'll be sick, it'll kill you. You can tell them all that. But if they leave their classroom and they go home and their parents are having a couple of glasses of wine at night, or, they are taking prescription medications, our experience and relationship with drug and alcohol as a culture is very much a part of life. We live in a land of vineyards. We're surrounded by the, you know, alcohol culture. Bars and cocktail and signature drinks are lauded as, you know, a really impressive way to spend a weekend. And again, the use of prescription drugs in our culture is absolutely skyrocketed in the last 40 years. And so you can't say to a child, don't do drugs, and yet as soon as they're out in the world outside of school, everyone in some way from their perspective is doing drugs and drinking. And so instead of giving them tools to actually understand the reality of the culture, we're setting them up to not know how to respond. They're either going to join the culture that they've been told is bad, and then when they find out it's not all bad, that it can be fun to have a glass of wine, that it can be social to, you know, have drinks with friends, or a prescription drug can help you maybe get healed. How do they deal with that conflict? And again, it's that all or nothing thought process that is not helpful. So the DARE program is one example of the all or nothing attitude. And I talked about behaviors in children that we can't, you know, just say to a child that behavior is wrong without giving them some understanding of why that behavior isn't helping them to succeed in life. You know, just telling a child stop acting out or stop running around or stop being obnoxious and sending them to their room or blowing up at them or yelling at them, the child doesn't learn that that behavior isn't going to help them make friends moving into the future or be able to get a job or to create relationships with other people. Like, knowing how to be socially acceptable is part of being a social animal in our culture. And so when we just tell a child that is bad and you are bad, go to your room, we're sending two messages that are unhelpful. The first one is, now the child feels like they're a bad person, and we've set up that split in them. I guess I'm just a bad person. And then when they do good things, they don't recognize it because they've been told they're bad. But no one's just bad. We're all both things, capable of both things. And then when we tell them that behavior is bad, but we don't give them an alternative to how to behave, they just get sneakier with the behaviors. Does that make sense?
Oh, totally. Yeah.
So the idea of DARE is one piece. The idea of behaviors is another piece. But the one that I really landed on for the show today is, again, got to stay with me because I think people's initial reaction is going to be, what? But it's the idea of bullying. You know, we talk and hear a lot about bullying in our culture, whether it's cyberbullying or bullying on campus, you know, children bullying each other. We see the statistics there. I just read another article about a young girl who was cyberbullied and committed suicide. I mean, it's a serious problem, and it's dangerous, and a lot of people are hurt by bullying. And I think, I don't know many people who haven't had an experience in their life when they were bullied. Everyone I know in some point in their life can tell a story about having been bullied, whether it was in school or in a job or in a relationship. I mean, we know what that feels like. And for some people, the bullying can be worse and more extreme. So I'm not denying that bullying is an issue or a great concern, or a mental health concern. My concern is how we address bullying in our culture, because again, it's become just a vilified action. It's all bad. Bullying is a horrible thing. It must be eradicated. We need to make it go away, just like drug and alcohol abuse or children who are acting out. You know, we need to eradicate that behavior and wipe it out. The problem is, you can't wipe out bullying. You can't end it. You can't legislate it out of existence. You can't bring children into a room and tell them stories or make them feel badly, and then they will stop bullying. It's a great hope, but it's not going to happen. And again, my fear is that it sets children up for not being able to cope with bullying when they step out of the safety of their school environment and into the real world, where we are a culture that bullies. So schools are spending a lot of money bringing in anti-bullying programs. They're spending a lot of money bringing in these one-day or two-day programs or week-long things or month-long things they do in schools to help children, you know, identify bullying and what to do when they're bullied and, you know, how to respond. And the intention is good. Again, I said at the beginning of the show, a lot of times our intentions are so good. How could they not be helpful if we're coming to this problem with our heart and saying we want all children to thrive. We want all humans to thrive. We don't want anyone to ever feel bullied. Those good intentions are so full and rich with positive intentions, but quite often we get so caught up in the positive intention we don't realize the unintended harm that's being caused. So let's play this out a little bit. When it comes to bullying, you can have a child go through a program at school, but then you've got to change the entire cultural social fabric that we've set up. Because in our cultural setup of capitalism, of economic growth, it's based on competition. It's based on this idea of dog eat dog, right? He who has the gold makes the rules. Winners and losers. You know, our government tends to have this powerful bullying way of getting their way around the world. And so if you tell a child that all bullies are bad and then they step out into the world and the workforce that they're now entering is a place that feels competitive and edgy and they're bullied by stronger people because everyone's trying to get ahead, get the next job, get the next promotion, right? Sell their business. You know, the culture we've created around our economy, around our government, around our interactions are very much about force. And maybe we would want to say bullying. Maybe bullying just sounds too harsh because we're talking about, you know, fair trade or business and, you know, it's all fair in business or in politics. That's how we get things done. We, you know, show force and might and then, you know, people will go our way. But in its raw form, it's bullying. And so how do we help young people learn the skills of competing and succeeding in our culture the way it stands? If we've been saying to them, you need to be nice to everyone, never bully anyone, don't be competitive, don't hurt feelings, right? We're not giving children the tools they need to step out into the real world and be able to compete, be able to stand up to bullies, to be able to recognize bullying when they see it and not just accept it as, well, maybe it's just part of the workforce. Or our other option is we change the entire social fabric. We change the entire context of our social relations. We stop this economy based on competition and aggression and success and winners and losers. If we want to alter the entire adult experience to mimic or replicate what we're teaching children in school, then that's a great program. Then we're setting children up to have the tools to go into a world that's full of support. But if we're giving children this idea that bullying is not okay and they should never participate and bullies are always bad, how do they cope with adult life when they meet people who look like bullies but are their boss, or look like bullies but are their president, but look like bullies? You know, you see what I'm saying. And so this idea that nothing is all bad or all good completely falls in this idea of bullying. And I'm not really saying that bullying on any level is good. I'm not trying to normalize it and say, well, you know, bullying's not all bad. Sometimes there's a great time to bully. I'm not being that cavalier, but I am trying to bring a little bit of reality to this idea that we live in a very aggressive world. And I want my children and I want all of our children to be able to thrive in the world we're sending them out into. And so we want to give them all the tools they can have to succeed. And it's not that I have an answer to this. I don't have an anti-bullying antidote. I don't have an alternative program. But I do think that we spend too much time throwing programs at issues, trying to deal with the symptoms of the issue, instead of really looking at the core source of the things we struggle with, like drug and alcohol abuse, or this tendency to bully, or, you know, mood disorders, if we want to go there. We have to look at the source, and quite often we kind of gloss over the depth of the source of the things we struggle with as individuals and as cultures and as a community and as a country. We gloss over the depth of the source and try to just address those symptoms, those bad behaviors that we want to eradicate. But just eradicating bad behaviors does not make them go away if you don't address the source. So that's where I am today. Nothing is all good or all bad. So how do we live with that dichotomy? How do we address and live with both pieces as individuals, as a culture, as a community, as schools? I'm curious to know your thoughts on this. Because I know it's a little esoteric. I'm kind of out there giving you a lot of thoughts without a lot of direct answers. Because I'm not really sure where we go with this. But I do know as individuals, we struggle with this idea that we should be all good all the time and strive to be like Mother Teresa. And yet we all have within us that devil, that spirited side, that part of us that's curious about the things that might be considered bad. And so do we reject ourselves because of those bad thoughts or those bad feelings, the things that would be considered bad? How do we find a wholeness of acceptance for ourselves and then translate that into looking at the world as a whole instead of trying to delineate black and white, bad and good, all or nothing thinking? What do you think about this? 805-781-3875 is a number to be part of the conversation today. I am Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. That was a long introduction to this story today because there's so much to it. But I'd love to know your thoughts. 805-781-3875. Are we able to sit with this idea that nothing is all good or all bad, that within anything we experience, there's a little bit of both? And what do we do with that? Do we reject things universally that we consider to be all bad? Do we just try to ignore them? If someone we're in a relationship with behaves in such a way that we find unsettling or unacceptable, do we reject that person fully and just let them go? They're a bad person. Or do we step back and try to measure all the times that we've found their behavior wonderful or acceptable? You know, in therapy, couples come in quite often dealing with this idea of splitting in the relationship, that they married someone with these rose-colored glasses and weren't they wonderful and everything about them was perfect and they said the right thing and did the right thing and they were magical and we get swept away in the love and the attention and that honeymoon period then at some point starts to wane. And that person that we idealized and put up on a pedestal becomes human. The wings start to fall off a little bit and maybe we start to have arguments or maybe they start to behave in such a way that isn't so wonderful. Maybe we're no longer the center of attention. Maybe they go through a rough patch and they struggle with some issues that make them less than appealing. Do we reject them at that moment? Does that mean that that's who they are now? That the person that we fell in love with and we accepted and felt connected to has now died and disappeared and has been replaced by this bad person? You see, because that's what we're talking about is that we tend to, in order to simplify our lives, to make it understandable, to make it more manageable, want to compartmentalize things into good and bad. You can act this way, but not this way. We can accept this activity, but not this activity. But when we start to split things off and have acceptable and unacceptable behaviors, then we start to fall apart. Because we can't sustain one way or the other for too long, because we're all things. 805-781-3875. I mean, maybe I've gone off on a limb here. This idea that nothing is all bad or all good, as Shakespeare said, it's how we perceive it. It's how we perceive the bad and the good, and then what we do with that perception that really determines how we react, how we behave, how we address that thing that we are struggling with. So you're listening to Public Radio, KCBX. You can participate on the phone. You can send us an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can find previous shows at kcbx.org. We're talking about things being good and bad, all good or all bad, and how once we have a perception in mind, we start to behave in such a way that reflects how we perceive what that behavior is. We'll come back to take your calls at 805-781-3875. You are listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, and I have posed the question today, how do we deal with things, behaviors, cultural norms, that we perceive in one hand to be bad, and yet they exist, and if we can't eradicate them completely, how do we learn to deal with the dichotomy of good and bad in the same place? So I'm going to bring up another example, and this is another one that you have to stay with me because on the surface, most people would say it's absolutely bad, shouldn't exist, is just dangerous and toxic to everyone. And that's the idea of gossip. Now, most people will not willingly say, I gossip, right? It's our cultural expectation that we shun gossip and gossipers and we look down on them and that all gossip is bad and that it's hurtful. And again, I'm not saying that toxic gossip or malicious gossip is wonderful and that we should accept it. What I'm trying to propose is that within the realm of gossip, there is gossip that is helpful and healthy and gossip that is toxic and damaging. But the two, you can't have one without the other. You can't have the helpful aspects of what gossip brings to societies and to families and to neighborhoods without the negative, malicious pieces. And also when people say, I don't gossip, I don't participate in that, generally that says to me that they're just really good at gossiping on the down low. Like I'd much rather have a conversation with someone who just flat out it says, I'm going to gossip something to you. I have something I'm going to tell you that I probably shouldn't share. Because then I kind of know where I stand with this person. They're just going to tell the stories and they're going to tell other people's stories. And I know where I stand. The more dangerous type of gossip comes from people who just swear that they never talk about anyone else and would never say a bad word about anyone else. And then they find some really insidious way to backhandedly say negative things about other people or to undermine other people, right? That may not look like gossip on the surface, but still you walk away from that conversation thinking, ooh, they just really slammed that person. And so it goes back to this idea that we can't legislate or beat people into submission to not participate in behaviors that we find unacceptable. We have to understand what the root causes of that behavior and work with it. So let's talk a little bit about the history of gossip. You know, there is a social context for gossiping. It's been called lamenting. It's been called sharing troubles. In the Greek fishing villages hundreds of years ago, when the men would go off for days on in the boats, the houses were all next door to each other, if you can picture that, on the street. And the women would step out on their front porch in the morning and hang their laundry, and then they would sing their laments, their troubles, kind of probably early rapping in some way. They would sing about, you know, their wayward husband going off to sea and not bringing back enough fish, and their child not holding up their end of the bargain. They would sing in this sing-song manner their troubles. And then all of the other ladies on the block would say, you know, I hear you. I, 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 understand, I'm with you. It was a way of kind of bringing the community together, that we would sing and lament our troubles, gossip of our family trials and tribulations, and it would actually bring us closer. And that's kind of the foundation of this idea of gossiping. It's a way of self-disclosing. It's a way of telling the details of our life stories to others. And within our families, and I don't know about yours, but within our family, we all know each other's business all the time. And to pretend that we don't know
Believe
each other.
Me. My mom and grandma were visiting over the weekend. I live two states away, and somehow my grandma knows all my business.
Absolutely. And yay for things like the smartphone, where we can actually like track where everybody is. We even know where each other had dinner if we followed the Find Your Friends. So it's built into our social fabric is this desire to kind of know each other's business. And so if you can just flow with that, you know, within the family and just accept that, well, you know, Aunt Betty or someone in the family always is the chain gossiper, right? They're the lead person. But those stories go around. And even though you might not want all of your business shared, or maybe you didn't want your sister to know this, or maybe you didn't want your parents to find something out, when it's all out in the open, when it's all there and being said and you can see it, the secrets are out in the open, people are healthier. They may be irritated, they may be annoyed, they may be a little embarrassed, right? They may be angry that it came out into the public of their social group, but we are healthier when things are out in the open. We are healthier when we know where everybody stands with us, even if it's uncomfortable. And in some ways, it can be fun to kind of know each other's story. Because the other part of the gossip is that it builds a social connection. I can tell stories about my brother and sister and parents. I can talk about the troubles or laments I might have about my children. But if anyone outside of my family group starts to talk badly about my family, what happens? They get completely shunned. How dare you talk about my brother, right? How dare you say anything about my father? Even with my husband, who I've been with for 37 years, if he starts to say something about my family and it hits me, I say, hey, you don't get to talk about them. And he's been in the family long enough, you'd think he'd have gossip rights. So we kind of, with gossip, create these family boundaries. And also within our social groups. You know, one of the big concerns about gossip is that young girls and older girls and women, because we learn our communication styles from our adults in our lives. And so young girls learn that gossiping behavior from their mothers and their aunts and their grandmothers. It's passed down every generation. It's not something that just happens in elementary school or junior high. It's a learned behavior. And what we found is that when young girls use gossip, quite often it is the malicious queen bee, mean girl, ousting someone from the group kind of gossip that can be really damaging and can make someone's life miserable. But what's interesting is that within tight-knit circles of friends, they can gossip about each other, same thing, and kind of odd man out them. But if someone outside of that girl circle tries to gossip about someone within the circle, they're shut down. You're laughing, Brie, because this is...
Sorry, no, I just got a text from my mom saying she's listening.
So now she wants to know what gossip you're talking about. That's so funny. You see, and look how we have the instant communication, because I know that my mom's listening and I imagine my daughters are. And so, you know, it's like there are no secrets. I have no secrets because my friend group listens to the show and they hear everything I talk about each week. And so when we get together, I'll, you know, start to talk about something going on in my life, and they'll say, oh, I already know, I listened to the show. I have nothing to share with my friends anymore because they know. But the idea of gossip is, at its most primitive form, is about social control. And people really don't like that term, but it's true. You know, when your mother says to you, are you going to go out in that outfit? Are you going to wear that today? What she's saying is, I don't want to be gossiped about by all of the neighbors in town. So change your outfit so that we can still be seen as acceptable. And there are ways, you know, that we use gossip to maintain our behavior, not just in our neighborhoods, but I use this example in school when I talk about gossip, that if you're in the Hell's Angels, there is a way you need to behave and dress to be part of the Hell's Angels, to be accepted into that social group of the Hell's Angels. You're going to wear your leathers and your jacket and ride your Harley. Like, it's a uniform. And if you showed up in seersucker pants or, you know, and a boater hat, you're going to get gossiped about by your fellow Hell's Angels. And they're going to oust you from the group. I mean, so not trying to minimize how gossip can be malicious. It's important to understand that it's not all bad and it's not all good, that it exists as it is. And if we can accept it and look at it and look at the root cause of gossip, which is this inherent desire we all have to connect and communicate and feel like we belong and to belong to groups, be accepted into groups, that's where it comes from. When we can understand where gossip comes from, it helps us to deal with and address malicious and negative gossip. How can we take that negative and malicious and make it more positive? Because think of every group you've ever wanted to be a part of, a sorority, a country club, a stamp collecting group, a sailing community. They all have their kind of unspoken and spoken rules, and you're going to behave in such a way that keeps you in the group for fear of being gossiped about. So another example of all good or all bad. What do you think about that? And I'm so surprised that no one takes issue with my thoughts about the anti-bullying campaigns and cyberbullying campaigns in schools, especially getting ready to go back to school. I'm surprised that apparently everyone agrees with me that we should let that go and spend money in other ways. Because in all honesty, I wish we wouldn't spend a dime on any of the anti-bullying campaigns and these very expensive programs schools bring in, and spend the money on a program like Destination Imagination, which brings kids together of all different backgrounds and talents and experiences and have them form teams and work on a project together. Like, use the money to fund programs like that that brings kids together and helps them get to know each other so they create new friend groups, instead of sticking them into a gym with a bunch of them where they sit with their friends they already know and hear someone talk about something that ultimately they're not going to follow anyway, because as soon as they leave school, they're going to be thrown into this competitive world and the bullying is going to be what it is. Why don't we take that same money and put it into programs that give children resilience, that teach them how to communicate, that teach them how to get along with others, that teach them how to compete, that teach them how to complete a project? Because unless we change our entire cultural landscape, the truth is bullying is a part of what it is to be a human. It's how people retain power when they don't know other ways to retain power. It's how countries get their way. It's how adults get their way. It's how corporations take over markets. You know, if you are a small business trying to sell your product in a competitive landscape and another business buys up four other small businesses and they're stronger and bigger, they're going to bully you out of the way to get your shelf space and maybe force you out of business. So instead of spending the time telling children not to bully and be mean to each other, let's teach them how to take their experiences in a more productive way. So I'm Elizabeth Barrett. And the phone number to be part of the conversation is 805-781-3875. And if everyone agrees with me, then I expect that every school will have a new way of spending that money that's set aside for bullying, and that we wouldn't fall back into the failed DARE program again, that we wouldn't tell children just don't do drugs and expect that that's going to stick because someone in a uniform came into their school and said don't. You know, those are not effective ways of dealing with cultural and societal problems. We have to address what drives those behaviors. Why do we have drug and alcohol issues in our culture? Because, well, one, it's normalized. There's a lot of advertising and glorifying of alcohol and social drinking. And as I said before, living amongst vineyards. You know, we are in a culture that makes cocktails look like an acceptable form of entertainment. And so you can't on one hand say to children, don't use drugs, don't drink, and then have it be a primary part of their adult experience. We have to look at what drives that behavior and help children have the tools to deal with it. And we have to be able to accept that things are not all good and all bad. 805-781-3875. So I see that my husband is called because we sat up last night and talked about this conversation, and you said that you disagreed a bit.
Hi. Well, you know, most businesses would not agree with the term bullying. There are laws and regulations that try to make a level playing field, and most businesses are complying with the laws and working within the regulations to get a better share of the market. So they consider that competition, not bullying.
So is it just the terminology that doesn't work?
Well, the terminology doesn't work, but, you know, deep down, when you get down to it, you're probably right. They're going to do anything they can that they're not going to get thrown in jail for mm-hmm. or fined for doing to win, to make more money, to win more market share, whatever their business is. But that's, like you said, that's the nature of our society. But businesses, sports teams, you know, I played water polo, and the refs can't see what's going on under the water, so everything was considered, you know, fair game, you know, including things that are in the rule book, not allowed. We're done. You know, whatever the ref doesn't know, everybody did. The coaches, and you know, maybe they didn't encourage it, but they certainly did not discourage it.
Right, so anything that's below the surface, which is a great metaphor, was fair game as long as above the surface you look like you were playing by the rules.
Yeah, but you know, on another different vector here, people, you know, a young girl gets bullied or whatever it is, gets harassed on the internet, on social media, and is driven to the point that she sees no way out and kills herself. You know, we can't just say let's not stop bullying. I mean, that's got to be addressed, and I don't know that Destination Imagination is the solution for that problem.
But what I said before is that I wasn't normalizing or saying that that's acceptable. My concern is that if we just throw programs at that behavior and we don't understand what drives people to bully someone else, right, or give people other outlets for interacting with each other, then we're not addressing the problem. We're just seeing the symptoms. And a child being driven to suicide because of bullying is a symptom of something that's deeper, I think, on a more deeper, more toxic level. And that is the story of what it is to be a winner in our culture, or to fit in, or to have a place where you feel like you belong. You know, it goes back to this idea that we're very disconnected as a culture. People feel very alienated. Our children spend a lot of time feeling connected by their phones and their social media, but they're not really connected in a way that is nurturing and makes them feel surrounded by love. And that's the kind of social problem that needs to be addressed before we can throw solutions at something like bullying. If a child has a strong, nurturing family system that they feel completely invested in and surrounded by, that builds up a resistance to peer bullying. I mean, that's statistically what we've seen, that families that have the strongest sense of values and traditions and interactions with each other, their children have the best inoculation to peer pressure and bullying. And so it doesn't seem to be a surprise that the busier families are and the less time they spend together, or the more distracted people are, the more vulnerable we are as individuals to things like bullying, because we don't have that strong fabric of connection holding us together.
Interesting. Yeah, that makes sense. And on regarding the DARE program, I agree. That was a waste. And it took on a life of its own. So police departments and schools were getting, you know, state funding, you know, to participate in the DARE program. And so it was not really as much. I mean, the goals may have been lost a little bit in interest of having that money and having those methods.
And again, thanks for calling in. I appreciate it, honey. I mean, also the idea that the good intentions are there. I'm not saying that good intentions aren't there when it comes to DARE programs and anti-bullying programs, but sometimes good intentions are not enough to address the issues. And sometimes a good intention thrown out there without understanding the whole context of this issue can end up being harmful. 805-781-3875 is the number to be part of the program. And Paula, thanks for calling in. What's on your mind?
Hi, I'm Paula, and I'm Bree's mom, and I was listening. And I am a third grade teacher.
Oh.
And I see the cry from parents that want an anti-bullying program, and we do teach an anti-bullying program, but I always think that I'm similar to your husband caller, that, you know what, there's bullying in the world and there's bullying that we can't see as teachers, but how are we teaching kids resistance? Mm-hmm. so that no matter what they come across in life, they will know what to do because, you know, they're not going to allow the bullying affecting them or strategies to make new friends, strategies to, you know, say, you know, let that water run right off my back because it's not going to affect me. And relational kinds of things like that. So what I hear from parents is when they feel their child's being bullied, they want me to take care of that other person's kid, not their kid. And I try and really talk to them about how they as a parent doesn't have much control over that other kid. But what they do have some input in is their own child, and how can they help teach their own child how to be resistant to bullies?
And I think that's such a great point, because that's what we keep falling back on, is it all happens within the family culture, that is our safe place, that is where our children learn their values and beliefs, that our public school is a place we send our children to learn how to be citizens, you know, but our home is where we teach our children how to get along emotionally, socially, culturally in the world. And I think that's where the big disconnect has come.
Right. And if you take those opportunities of learning how to deal with those problems at a younger age, then when they get older and deal with drugs, alcohol, sex, etc., they won't have the tools of dealing with peers, you know, as if they eradicate all of those problems that they had for them, you know, but they should be holding their hands. Parents need to be holding their hands while they themselves, they see their kids go through it, and they help their kids go through it, rather than saying, take those problems away.
Right, right. Make my child's experience easier for them, which in the end is going to end up being a greater challenge. And Paula, have you seen in your years of teaching, is bullying a bigger problem than it was 20 years ago?
Well, I teach third grade, so it's a little bit easier because they don't have social media access as much. You know, they do some gaming and that kind of stuff they might do, but they don't have I haven't seen it's to me it's normal social issues that come up, and now it's just labeled with bullying rather than working through issues.
So you haven't seen it really change in nature. It's just how it's being perceived in the school culture has changed. Mm-hmm. Right? Those same behaviors have been labeled or identified as something else.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's what I've seen.
Well, thank you for calling in. And it's definitely an all-family show today, Paula, between you and Bree and my husband.
No, it's the Zender...
Barrett
crossover.
exactly. But I appreciate you calling in, because it is scary to make that phone call. And I think in a topic like this, which tends to be a little heated, people are a little afraid to talk out about bullying and the DARE programs and drug and alcohol and gossip. You know, it's much easier to just say it's all bad and hold that spot. But it takes a lot of courage to say maybe it's not as simple as it's just bad. Maybe bullying is part of, you know, how children learn socially to interact with each other. And if their behavior is unacceptable by their peers, then our hope is that they alter their behavior so that they can be part of a peer group. And that if our families, you know, and this again, I go back to the importance of having rituals and traditions and family activities that your kids count on and that give them a strong sense of personal identity. That's how we build resilience against peer pressure and bullying in the world, is if children have such a strong sense of who they are and where they come from, what it is to be a Zander, what it is to be a Barrett. When they step out into the world and the world comes flying at them, then they have the tools to lean on. It's like, yeah, this is horrible and I'm feeling like I'm overwhelmed, but I know I'm a Zander. I know I'm a Barrett, and that is going to give me the strength to go through.
It's the safety net of being home and going, oh, you know, I had a horrible day, and this is what happened.
Yes.
Okay, you're right. You did. That is a terrible day. What can we do? But how can we help you? You know,
absolutely.
I'll hold your hand while you let's go talk to the teacher together and you talk, or you go and talk to that person or something like that. But I'll help give you some tools of what to say.
Yes. And it may not always work out, right? You may not just eradicate that bully in your class. You may never, have an easy time. There always is going to be something that's a struggle. And that's the other piece of this, is that we can never sanitize the world in such a way that everyone is safe and comfortable all the time. And it's disingenuous for us to tell anyone that we can create a space that's just safe and sanitized for their pleasure, that we have to always be resilient and able to pull from our own internal resources to deal with challenges, whether it's drug and alcohol use, whether it's bullying, whether it's gossip, or whether it's in relationships, and knowing whether a relationship is healthy for us or maybe this person is tearing us down. We have to come to those situations with a strong sense of self. Paula, thank you for taking the time to call. It's kind of fun to have the family all chime in, because we did have, my husband and I went back and forth last night at the dinner table, and I was saying, here's what I want to talk about tomorrow. And he's like, I don't know if that's going to go over. But I appreciate his input. And I also hope that this motivated some conversations that you might have with your family and your friends to talk about how we address things like bullying and drug and alcohol abuse and gossip, and how do we build a resilience in ourselves and in our family in such a way that they can go out into the world and take on those challenges and still feel whole and come home and still feel the love of the family. Even when we are not our best self, if we can still feel the love of our family, be accepted when we are not behaving in such a way that might be considered admirable, that we can be both things. We can be charming and we can be rude. We can be loving and we can be cold. We are all things. Nothing is just good or just bad. It is what we think about it that makes it so. And this has been a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. I look forward to continuing this conversation again next week. You can find me on my Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist. You can also send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com or listen to previous shows at kcbx.org. And you can continue supporting public radio KCBX by donating on the Donate tab at kcbx.org.